Pressures and expectations. Well, my recommendation is to just breathe. Try your best to be your authentic self. Make your own traditions. You know, I was talking to a friend just today who told me he and his wife argued all during Christmas because they weren't splitting up their time between their parents equally enough. Phew. That doesn't sound like fun. I felt sorry for him. Now, me and Roy, our family is 2,500 miles away. It's easier for us to have whatever kind of holiday celebration we want. And I got to admit, I'm grateful for that because I can remember past holidays with family. Wow. Someone was always mad in the family, didn't actually spark happiness or cheer, I have to admit. I went through life thinking everyone had a healthier, happier family than me. You know, I will never forget that movie with Holly Hunter. I think it's called Home for the Holidays. Well, that movie became my all-time favorite holiday movie because Holly Hunter had a crazier family than I did. Rent it. I highly recommend it. You'll love it, especially if you're trying your best to juggle family obligations and family dysfunction this year. You'll have to laugh, I promise. Well, if you're new to the show, I'm your hostess, Karen Tate, and I'm the author of two books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and my other book is Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. And I have a special online offer of both books for $25 if you live in the United States. So check it out if you're still looking for stuff for holiday gifts. The second one tells about how a girl like me from the Bible Belt can get the calling from the sacred feminine and take her life down a path she sure never expected. And Sacred Places of Goddess, well, it tells you about the diversity of goddess and her spirituality, past and alive today across continents and cultures. Opening the show tonight was the music of Lisa Thiel, and the cut was called Warrior Goddess. Maybe that's what you felt like as you maneuver the parking lots and department stores and family stumbling blocks the last few weeks. Well, I think I have another great show for you tonight. First up is Duffy DeMore, otherwise known, Delphine DeMore, otherwise known as Duffy, who's going to talk to us about empowering women in the 21st century. We'll get into the social cost to men and women for the presumption of male superiority, why women don't feel equal, though we do have many rights, the devaluation and undervaluation of female strengths, and much more, including the question, what if we were born into a world where women were the standard? Then following my chat with Duffy, returning as a fan favorite, Dr. David Hillman, discussing how contemporary people misunderstand the gods and goddesses and how the ancients had a very different relationship with deity than we do today. Some of the topics will include, does fear have a place in paganism? How pagan prayers differ from monotheistic prayer? Why should we worship demons? Why you can't be a follower of the gods and be a believer in the inner God, and much more. David always promises to be controversial and fun and interesting. But first, I want to tell you about a great DVD. It's called Dancing with Gaia by Joe Carson. Blood of her veins, the rivers, voice of her breath, the wind, fire of her will, those erupting volcanoes, think about Pele, green of her hair, the rolling grass hills, and the strength of her spine. Well, that's those tall backs of the mountains. Persephone, moon maiden, whose returning steps grant springtime once more. Those are some of the opening words from that Dancing with Gaia DVD. It's a wonderful film about the goddess, sacred sexuality, and about connecting to the earth and ways to do that. It gives you tools to connect in a very real way to the landscape and spirit of the earth around you. It's also visually stunning. And the DVD comes packaged with a useful booklet, and both are only $20. You can find them at dancingwithgaia.com. I highly recommend it. I've seen it. It's good. Learn about connecting with the landscape of the goddess, both internally and externally. Well, I also have just a couple shout-outs. First, happy birthday, Mom. Yep, Mom, if you're listening. And may Goddess grant you all you wish for in the coming year. I also want to thank Molly and Donna for their kind words, your guests and my tank ladies. Okay, I guess now it's time to turn my attention to our first guest tonight. Let me tell you a little bit about Duffy before we start our chat. She is a clinical psychologist in private practice in Tarzana, California. She specializes in adults who have a history of trauma, in couples, and in human growth and development. The growth and development part of her practice includes relationship deepening, self-growth, and motivation through meditation, creativity, and refining the inner experience. She has presented workshops that include meditation and experiential exercises to enhance personal awareness, encourage greater creativity, produce more powerful satisfaction with life, and more encompassing acceptance of loved ones. Many have benefited from attending one of her workshops. In addition, Dr. Damore is an ordained high priestess of the goddess and holds rituals in her honor for the sun sabbats and full moon with her partner priestess, Laura. So, Duffy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Karen. It's nice to be here.
Well, I'm glad to finally have you on to chat. And I think what better way to start the new year off than talking about women's empowerment and their disempowerment in some places and the symptoms of that, the side effects of that. And it felt like to me there was nothing more clear than the headlines in the paper the last few days. I saw where a young woman in India was gang raped, and I have to admit I wasn't totally aware of this being a problem in India. I'd heard about it in China, but this Indian man came on talking about the story and attributed the rape to the fact that there is really becoming a serious shortage of women, especially in northern India, especially to poor men who don't have a lot to offer because of infanticide. We're seeing that this shortage of women, because the girls have been devalued at birth, literally is resulting in, you know, this problem where there aren't enough women to go around. Your
yes.
thoughts on that?
Well, my first thought on that is that we think of China and India as places that are so extremely populated that that the shortage of women has not ever really been a serious consideration. But with the attempts to move into the 20th century on the part and become more industrialized, both of these countries have attempted to start limiting their population, which has translated into limiting the number of girls, which, you know, it probably didn't take a genius to figure out that somewhere along the line that would mean that the men would outnumber the women and create a problem, right? As far as this thing with rape goes, I don't want this to go by without saying that for the most part, rape is not an act of desire. Rape is an act of anger. So the frustration part of this makes sense to me. That men who feel frustrated and angered at the fact that women are not available to them considerate their right to take this into their own hands and use a woman as an object to vent their spleen and their frustration. Now, this is not about men who are looking for loving relationships and feel bereft at the fact that they can't find someone to love. These are men who are enraged by their situation and circumstances, and women are considered a legitimate target because they are devalued in so many ways. And we see so many different kinds of things across the globe where this kind of behavior it seems abhorrent to us, but it is tolerated. You know, women being stoned in the Middle East because of perceived infidelity, or driving a car at night, or
right.
You know, these things are all in the same vein.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this devaluing of women raises its head in so many ways, and maybe we don't feel it quite so much here in the United States. You know, while we do have stuff like female genital mutilation, we do have domestic violence, but even on lines of domestic violence, do you think even that is a symptom of devaluing or undervaluing women? If men really thought, you know, the type of men who commit domestic violence, if they really thought women were their equal, would they abuse women like that? Is domestic violence a symptom of the devaluation of women?
Actually, domestic violence is a little more complicated, well, probably a lot more complicated than that, in my estimation. With my background in trauma, what seems, and in development and neurobiology, it really seems to me that domestic violence is a combination of men's deprivation of deep and intense mothering combined with a resentment of how much they're dependent on women for those kind of tender, loving things. And so it becomes a kind of anger and frustration that they're not getting what they need, and they feel it's legitimate to take that anger out on women. That's the devaluation part.
I understand you just to say that part of the domestic violence is lashing out because they're not loved?
Yes. Lashing out because our society does not value and honor mothering at a level that allows women to be open and available to their infants on many levels. You know, and obviously this can be overridden in certain families, but in a lot of families it becomes multi-generational.
Right. Well, right. I forget. I think his name was Art Noble. I had him on the show quite a long time ago, and one of the things that stuck out in my head, he said, was if we could do one thing in society to help things along, it would be to make it okay for boys to spend more time with their mothers and not have to be detached from her so soon. And I think he's saying, he was probably saying the same thing you're saying here.
Yes, that's exactly true. What we know neurobiologically is that because of how nature has it set up, on a lot of physical levels, girls get more advantages than boys because girls carry the next generation, and you know that's something nature has never compromised with. So developmentally, boys develop on a somewhat slower trajectory than girls do, which is why most of the way through elementary school, girls do much better in school.
Hmm.
Yeah, one of the reasons that, you know, and boys don't really catch up until high school. So here you have little boys who are more vulnerable developmentally on all kinds of scales, but including emotional development, and they're the ones who are supposed to be tougher earlier. You know, where because those male standards hold, they're not supposed to need their mothers as much. They are expected to be separated from their mothers more. So not only does it mean that they can't get as much mothering, but it means the fact that they need more mothering makes them ashamed of themselves and makes them resent their mothers because they need them.
Wow. Well, and, you know, here I'm connecting the dots from past shows again. Hannah Rosen, who wrote the book The End of Men, meaning male dominance, not mm-hmm. the end of the gender.
Right.
She was talking about that women, even as they're getting older now. I mean, you were just talking about, you know, in grade school. I mean, I remember the girls were always smarter than the boys. You know, girls mature faster. And now Hannah Rosen is talking about now even in later life. There's more girls graduating from college. Economically, women are becoming more and more independent. Men are in trouble. You know,
absolutely. And that is that's largely the responsibility of the male domination, the male model of domination, is that any place that women move into is by definition somewhat devalued. So as women became more and more present in college, going to college was less valuable. As women become more and more successful in different places in business, men are less attracted to it.
But what I'm starting to wonder, and please feel free, you know, guests can always correct me if I'm wrong because I want to learn from your expertise. What I'm, the dots I'm connecting in my head are men or, you know, maybe this sounds a little drastic, I don't mean it quite so, but it sounds like men are really on the verge of becoming less powerful. If, you know, it's like women are going to surpass them. They surpassed them as when they were young in school. Now they're surpassing them later in life where, the men had been the breadwinners. The men controlled the families. You know, now more women are equal or, you know, maybe making more money than men. It feels like men are losing ground, perhaps, rather than the arenas that women are in aren't quite so important anymore. Or do you think it's both?
Well, I think it's both. I think it's part of the huge transition and shift that has been going on for a while now away from that male patriarchal dominancy. And so we're going to see some places where, as things get more equal, men who are not prepared to make those adjustments, which is to say developmentally don't have the flexibility because of the lack of mothering. Listen, mothering can be done by men too. It's that nurturing, loving environment. So it's not, I'm not saying that the only person who can do it is mothers, but because of a lack of that developmental resource, a lot of men come into adulthood with less flexibility. So their adjustment to a world that they weren't raised to expect is much more difficult for them.
Yeah, I think the phrase Hannah used was they're saying women are not women anymore.
which is another way of saying because women are not being like I expect them to be, that means it's not possible for me to be a man because women aren't acting like women.
Right.
All right. And I think that's a huge deprivation, and it's an underestimation of both men and women.
So really, when we go back to the, sort of come full circle, I guess, what we're really talking about is society not valuing the attributes of the feminine, empathy, relationship, mothering. If those things really were valued, if we really believed in, quote, family values, those would be high on our priority list, but they're not.
Yes, those would be the things that would be supported and valued they'd be trained for them. Who gets training in motherhood?
Nobody.
You know what I mean? For the most part, the only training any of us gets for being parents is having been children.
True.
Okay.
True. So, you get that, you know, people say, oh, well, it just comes naturally. But does it?
Well, it does come naturally, but it comes out the way it went in.
Ah.
So if you don't want to do parenting the way it came to you, you have a lot of difficulties with that because you don't have any training for it. What you have training for is doing it the way it was done for you. Now, that doesn't mean that a large number of people don't override it. You know, it's a well-known, you know, statistically, only a third of children who are abused as children grow up to be child abusers themselves. So people do override what they learned in childhood, but it's a struggle.
So what makes one person able to overcome it, Duffy, and the other person just succumbs to and perpetuates that vicious cycle?
Well, a lot of it is developmentally entrained. If you have a mother who has the capacity to be really present and engaged with you and not intrusive and is able to recognize what you need and provide it for you over a long enough period of time in those first 3 years, you have a resiliency and a flexibility and and coping mechanisms that serve you throughout the rest of your life. Now, I mean, you know, barring mental illness and other kinds of dramatic trauma and injury that can't be recovered from, for the most part, we're finding more and more and more things that go directly back to in utero, the state of the mother, and mothering abilities and styles all the way back to the beginning. We're finding more and more that, for instance, long-term illness, or not long-term illness, but say heart disease that comes online when a person is 50 or 60 can be causally traced back to things that happened in early childhood.
That have nothing to do with the heart. You mean just some sort of trauma?
Some sort of trauma, maybe a one-time trauma, or maybe some kind of ongoing anxiety production.
Hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of research going on in epigenetics about the multi-generational effects of experience that doesn't change DNA, but it changes how the individual genes are triggered. What gets turned on and what gets turned off can go on for generations from a single kind of change early in someone's life.
Yeah. Well, you know what that says to me, and maybe I'm going overboard with this, and if I am, tell me. But that tells me if, you know, you were impoverished or, you know, you were an oppressed class, then you are more likely to carry those sorts of traumas, those sorts of sicknesses. You aren't going to be as healthy later on in life.
That's exactly what we're finding. But the opposite is also true. You know, if you have really, really good kinds of experiences that serve you really, really well, that also can tend to be passed on a purely physiological level. So a person can be born with more resiliency because of things that have happened in previous generations that they've never had the experience of, but that they're born with that epigenetic quality built in.
Where if they were just sort of beat down and have low self-esteem and have a miserable life, then the chances of overcoming are a lot less.
That's right, which brings me to one of my favorite themes, which is that women under the patriarchy suffer from multi-generational post-traumatic stress symptoms.
Interesting. So now this all makes sense. When I saw your talking points, I didn't quite understand that, but now I'm really starting to get it. And so since women have been oppressed for so long, I mean, how do these things sort of manifest? Is it something you can recognize when a woman comes into your practice?
Well, let me put it this way. Once you start to look at the symptoms of it, it's hard to not recognize it. It's because it's so pervasive. okay? Mm-hmm. We live in a time where women have sexual freedom, where women have rights in the workplace. You know, women are working at things now that were unheard of when I was in high school in the 60s. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And most girls come out of, you know, graduate from high school, come out of adolescence with the idea that they can do anything.
Right.
Yeah, on the one hand. So they're going to college and being successful. But we also have women who work, say, sexually from a male model. Having sexual freedom means having indiscriminate numbers of sexual partners.
Mm-hmm.
Well, women don't operate sexually that way. What's interesting is that for men, having lots of sexual partners tends to raise their self-esteem, and for women, it tends to lower their self-esteem.
So is that one of the ways women, though we've gotten more rights, we don't really feel equal, you know?
Yeah, right, because our rights are based on being like men.
Ah.
Okay, as
mm-hmm.
opposed to women being raised that women are different from men. And, you know, some of this is, you know, is very unintentionally the fault of the most recent women's movement, because their message was women can do what men can do, which in some ways got translated into women and men are the same.
Or right. So this, and that is an example that to be liberated means to be promiscuous, but not really.
That's
that
right.
Sameness, sameness is sort of overrated.
Not just that; it's simply biologically not true. Men and women's brains operate differently. You know, sexually, for instance, women's brains are different parts of women's brains are stimulated sexually than men's are. Different parts of the brain light up in an MRI study under sexual circumstances for men than for women. We have a different experience of things.
Hmm.
All right? And part of this has been engendered by research. Up until the 90s, most of the research, say, on post-traumatic stress disorder was done on men. Because women's place in their menstrual cycle added another dimension to the research, so they couldn't have as robust a result. So until the 90s, everything that's been studied about post-traumatic stress disorder was based on a male model that was attempted to be applied to women.
So how does the menstrual cycle alter this?
Well, because of our changing place in the cycle, we have different emotional reactions to things, and we're engaged in a cyclical kind of inner experience,
mm-hmm.
whereas men's experience tends to be more consistent.
Okay.
Sexual.
Okay.
Okay. And so when the research started to, you know, there was a change in policy so that research on post-traumatic stress disorder had to also include women. Well, when they started to do the women's data, what they started to find was that under traumatic circumstances, women's tendency was to, for men, it was always fight or flight,
mm-hmm.
and then freeze. For women, it tends to be tend and befriend.
Right.
Under trauma, women tend to become concerned about the captor and trying to befriend them. And if you think about that from an evolutionary standpoint, it certainly makes sense.
Yeah, so that's why we've sort of embraced our captors, our oppressors, instead of fighting back.
Absolutely. And which was a much more likely survival strategy for women throughout history.
That's very interesting. And that answers another question for me, you know, because I've always wondered. I mean, I know we've heard, well, it happened differently in different places and, you know, over a long period of time. But I guess I always wondered why there wasn't more resistance to the shift, you know, to the patriarchy.
Right. Well, the thing is, what we don't know, because so much of it isn't historically documented, is what kind of resistance there was. But let's face it, women's weapons are not clubs and spears.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Women's weapons are friendship. It's motivation. It's also manipulation. You know, when women are disempowered, it's manipulation. It's conspiracy. And it's aligning ourselves with the powerful in order to have secondary power, if that's all that's available to us.
So, I can't help it. I just had a big flash of Sarah Palin just flashed in front of my eyes.
Uh-huh. Well, that's what I said. Here's this woman who is as cute as she can be, who is such a product of that patriarchal devaluation of everything that is real and powerful about women.
Hmm. Well, now let me ask you this, because recently you and I were having this conversation about the difference in the brains between liberals and conservatives.
Yeah.
Does this also apply to what we're talking about here, or is that a totally different subject?
Well, it probably does apply in some way. I just don't know of any concrete research that's been done.
Okay.
Okay. I know on the conservative and liberal research, that's been done and it's been documented. In other words, it's been done in different places at different times where they have actually taken liberals and conservatives and done brain scans on them. And then conversely, they've taken a random sampling of people across the board and done brain scans, and they've found that they can identify the liberals and the conservatives out of an unnamed population on the same scale that they were looking at the liberals and the conservatives when they, you know, kind of got in line for it. So those differences exist, and I'm sure there's similar kinds of differences that exist in this particular area, and there may even be research on it. I'm not particularly aware of it at this time.
Yeah, because it would be really interesting to know how liberal and conservative women operate differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a difference there, you know, in either their nurturing or their tendency to befriend the oppressor. Anyway.
Well, I mean, see, the tend and befriend tendency under traumatic circumstances is a big part of what has been used against women throughout patriarchal history to literally turn us against ourselves.
Hmm.
Because they could not have subjugated all women if we didn't become co-conspirators with them.
Right, right.
And whatever was left of women's resistance to the patriarchal Christianity in Western Europe was certainly completely wiped out in the Inquisition, where women by the hundreds and thousands were burned for witchcraft. Any woman who showed a lick of power was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They
mm-hmm.
also had, interestingly enough, they had a significant shortage of women in Europe shortly after that time as well.
Right. And here we go again.
I mean, it's like, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. You know, these are
Well, you're also making me think about something else, because I remember I had this discussion with someone a long time ago about talking about the feminine versus the masculine. And she was saying, Karen, you got to get beyond that. You know, what we want to do is just get beyond that, you know, because we all have feminine, we all have masculine. And I would, and my argument was, well, you know, we have to start to value the feminine before we can get beyond that, you know.
Well, yeah, which goes back to mothering, you know, from my point of view.
But what I wonder, though, Duffy, is what she was saying was a mistake, because wouldn't that fall into the sameness trap then?
From this perspective, it does. But think of it from this other perspective. You see, for men, and this is true globally, for men in male thinking and male relationships, the highest priority thing is status. Who's got the best status? You know, it's why men need different things in relationships than women, because they need to feel like they have some status in their relationships. For women, the most important thing is intimacy and connection.
Mm-hmm.
You can see this when, you know, when you have men going out to lunch together and women going out to lunch together. If a group of men's going to go out to lunch together, one of them, one with the highest status, either decides where they're going to go or tells somebody or assigns someone the job of telling us where we're going to go. And there's no question about it. Men are really comfortable with that. If women go out to lunch together, it takes us 15 minutes to come up with a consensus about where we all want to go. Right?
Yeah.
This is how women operate.
And
so,
I'm thinking, in status, too, that's why the guy goes and buys the sports car, right?
Exactly.
Kind of another status thing.
Because this is considered, this is an external sign of status.
Well,
the kind of
the
car you drive.
Maybe the woman's status is her kids are dressed nice or something like that.
Right. But women are much more likely to look for approval from each other and much more likely to gang up on somebody and be against them if they express more status, so to speak. Because closeness and working together is much more a female strength. All right, so under patriarchal rule, where patriarchy is the standard, competition, who's on top, success at any price, all of those things are the standards. If women are in charge, closeness and engagement, equality, balance, these are the female focusing.
Okay.
So as women are more powerful, that balance starts to be a part of, that's part of the value. It's part of the standard.
I'm wondering,
a switch from patriarchy to matriarchy that women were then in charge and would treat men the same way that women have been treated. No, we would, you know, for women, you know, women are the mothers. So men are our children, our brothers, our, you know, they're not our possessions, they're our connections, they're who we are engaged with, they're who are important to us. So being intimate and connected with them is just as important as with other women.
Well, and I can see where if we started to appreciate sort of what makes women tick, and
yes,
you know, make it, and then that benefits the whole world.
That's my thought. That's exactly my point.
Because yeah, then we have a world of more equality, a world of more egalitarianism, rather than this up and down thing.
Right. Exactly. And a world that values, you know, where the most important value is life and the quality of life, rather than who wins and who loses.
Yeah, you see, that's the thing that would that gets me so mad when this political stuff is always going on.
Yeah.
You know, you always hear this talk about, you know, from the Republicans. They're the ones that make me mad. My listeners know where my leanings are. and you know, because they're always talking about the makers and the takers, and that sort of thing. Hear them talk about quality of life, you know, because if they did talk about quality of life, they would have to worry if children had food to eat, you know.
Right, exactly.
But
I mean, Gloria Steinem caused a furor in the late 60s, because at one point in one lecture she said women are basically socialists.
Yes.
Because women are concerned about the lives of children everywhere.
Right.
We are concerned about what happens to humans everywhere. So, if you know, that social consciousness is part of women's values, which gets lost in patriarchal values to the detriment of both men and women.
Well, and really, when you think about patriarchy of the father, you know, good fathers, you would think, would care about the world's children, too.
You would think, you know, and you would think that they would be extremely protective of and valuing of their daughter's strengths and weaknesses and supportive of the contributions that their wives make because and in partnership. But so often,
what's the disconnect?
What? It's the social the socialization of the stratification. Where I mean, you can see it more clearly in Chinese and Japanese social structures, where women are only important for the sons they can provide.
Hmm.
You know, where intimate, close relationships are not part of the historical social structure. Now, they come from a whole different background than the Judeo-Christian one that we come from. But nonetheless, that's the same. Only it's more, even more clear in, you know, in ancient Japanese and Chinese cultures, where women are, you know, women's feet are bound and men have, you know, they go to the geishas for entertainment and their wives are just not valued in that way. It's and in Western culture, of course, we're moving more and more towards equality, but what you see more and more is that the deficit of that honoring of mothering and honoring of women when they're very, very young leaves men at more and more of a deficit as they get older. A lot of men. Yeah, you're really, really good men almost always. You can look back to having some kind of ongoing mothering that has really, really served them well.
So so did I understand you right that the Asian cultures have, or even a little bit worse in terms of valuing the feminine, the nurturing, than in our Western culture?
I don't think that I want to say that because I don't have enough expertise on it to actually say that. All I mean is that it's more codified into the culture.
Okay.
Okay, so that it's easier to see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I know that I attended the screening of that documentary that's going to be coming out soon, Femme, by Emmanuel Etier, and there were some Asian women who spoke in the film and talked about how women business owners are a big threat to Asian men. And in fact, if women are successful in business, they have to hide it in order to get a husband. You know, they also have to hide if they have a good education, where I don't think it's so bad, you know, for Western women as it seems like it is for, you know, women of the East.
Well, yeah, especially now. But, you know, you think about in the 40s, there was a song that was really famous by Nat King Cole called Ballerina, Dance, Ballerina, Dance. And just ignore the seat that's empty in the second row because you chose your career instead of marrying this guy. You know, and what a heartbreaker that was that she doesn't get to have love because she chose her career.
Ah. So
that's a part of our underlying structure, even if it's not so obvious as it is in Asian cultures.
Yeah, because, you know, I can remember, you know, my mother never said it to me, but I can remember hearing it growing up that don't be too smart, don't beat the boys at things.
So exactly. You read it in all the women's magazines.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You know? And, I mean, you could still read it, even though, yeah, they're a lot sexier, but it's, you know, what men like in bed.
Right.
The secrets of getting your man.
Yeah, always about pleasing them.
Right. Right. You know, I mean, and what do they say in men's magazines? You know?
They're not worried about the woman so much, huh?
Right. Buy this car.
Buy you. So, all right. So how do we change things for the future, Duffy, realistically? How do we empower women and how do we nurture more men?
Well, this is sort of what I've been focusing on for a while now in my practice. I've started a group for women called Awakening Woman's Spirit. And the premise of that group is what you read in the beginning. What if you were born into a world where the fact that you were a girl is what made your whole family proud and rejoice? That the fact that you could give birth to the next generation was honored and revered, and so people lit candles because they had another girl in their village. You know, what if you came into a world that treated women as on a standard that's different from men, and they were really valued that way? And mm-hmm. so we are looking at each individual developmental stage and what got twisted and distorted about women's experience that devalues it. You know, for instance, when we talk about menarche and the beginning of menstruation, we talk about how in many, many ways we were embarrassed about beginning our periods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where we didn't want any boys to know that we bled. You know, how crazy is that?
Right.
That the essential thing that brings the next generation and guarantees the continuation of humanity is an embarrassing thing for young girls.
Yeah, I mean, pregnant women, remember the big controversy when Demi Moore was on the front of the magazine with her naked belly?
Exactly. Or women being chastised for nursing their babies in public.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, these things that are, they're an essential part of humanity, but they're only considered kind of shameful because they are significantly female.
Right.
It's not like men, so men don't want to know about it.
Right.
And consequently,
right.
Women are inherently embarrassed of it. How much of that is epigenetic, multi-generational humiliation at just being a woman? How much of it is what we learn from those messages that we get throughout our culture? Now, I mean, my mother used to call her period, she used to say, I'm coming sick.
Oh, yeah, mine too, I'm sick. Or the curse. You know,
right.
that's so typical.
Right. So, and what do little boys grow up thinking? If you can't talk about menstruation, and everything about menstruation is the girls treat like it's shameful, and it's considered a sickness of some kind.
Yeah,
this
or
is how boys get the idea that everything about being a woman is yucky.
But now we have the Red Tent Movement, so that's starting to educate.
Right, it's such a fantastic antidote.
Right.
It's not just the education. You know, we've been doing sex education in elementary schools for years. It's the experiential honoring of and embracing our female functioning as a valued and divine thing, if you will.
Well, and I'm thinking too, you know, when we see I'm sort of getting my mouth is not going as fast as my brain.
Yeah.
You know, in response to some of the things you said, I was remembering how when Boehner cried, that was okay. But when Hillary shed a tear, oh, it's the weak woman thing, you know. But
exactly.
Yet,
good
but yet here
point.
Now we have Hillary Clinton, who everybody is raving, is this wonderful Secretary of State.
Yes.
So I don't know, does that sort of teach the world that, yeah, you can lead the world and you can cry all, you know, and both are okay?
Well, that's the message in it. And it certainly says to our girls that being a woman and being, because Hillary Clinton does things like a woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when she gets tough in a way that expresses her compassion.
Right.
Right?
Right.
We can't do this because it's bad for the world.
Right.
Right? When she is moved and compassionate, she's comfortable expressing those feelings. And people
and I love recently, too, when she wasn't wearing makeup,
mm-hmm.
and it was like, I don't need to hear about it. It's just no big deal. You
yes.
know, she didn't have to succumb to the pressure of patriarchal ideals of beauty. You know, I loved it when she did that.
Yeah, and it says to girls, this is what being a powerful, honorable, admired woman is like too.
Mm-hmm.
This is another vision. It's not just women rock stars,
mm-hmm.
or fashion models that are that personification of the objectification. Here's a woman who has done important, valuable things,
mm-hmm.
and been honored and admired by the world for her contribution. This is a model of women too.
Well, and it all goes back to love, doesn't it? Love and nurturing.
It does.
When I asked you the other night, when we were talking about the difference between liberals and conservatives, and we talked about conservatives are the way they are because they're so fear-based, and how do you help them overcome that fear? I think you said, maybe it's one person at a time as they learn love, and when they learn love and intimacy, maybe they aren't so fearful. It feels like, it's like that's really what the whole world desperately needs. Mothers nurturing, conservatives need love. God, it's like, can we just turn on a spigot somewhere?
Well, this is the thing about love.
Fill everybody up with some love, and then, maybe they'll be more loving. And
okay, well, this is the thing about love. Love is the most powerful force in the universe.
It's not just a cliche.
No, it is not just a cliche. If you love someone enough, no matter how much, on an individual basis, obviously not a global basis, on an individual basis, if you love someone enough, no matter how much that is negative and rejecting they throw at you, on an ongoing basis, you touch them. They may not ever get to love you in the same way or at the depth that you love them, but you touch them and it calms, it regulates the intensity of their negative feelings at you.
Hmm.
All right? And this is the essence of mothering from the beginning. We need a good, loving mother because that is what gives us the internal model of how to regulate all of our feelings so we can tolerate our whole array of emotional experience at intense levels at the top and at the bottom.
So, Duffy, are you saying that when, and I don't know if you are, but are you saying when people shit on us, when people treat us badly, that it's really better to return that with something kind than it is to, I don't know, blow them off or say something nasty back?
Let's hang on for a second. I am not in favor of anybody volunteering to be victimized.
No,
okay?
I don't mean that either.
No, I know what you mean. But so if someone is really, if someone is shitting on you, you have to have enough distance from them that you're safe first.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But if someone is, say, let's say something more garden variety, somebody's really angry with you,
mm-hmm.
the way that will ultimately help them be calmer and get past being angry, if it's possible for them to engage in some kind of a discourse, is for you to be calm and compassionate and empathic.
Right, right.
Okay?
Because mm-hmm.
if you get angry and retaliate, you both escalate each other.
Right, right. You had fuel to the fire.
Right.
I know there was this guy in our building that was just this really gruff, gruff guy. And every morning my husband just real nice would say, "Hi, how are you? Hi, how are you?" Every day, every day, every day. Year in and year out, year in and year out. And he wore this guy down. After a couple of years, this guy actually started to smile and say hello back.
I rest my case.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? Now, I mean, clearly if somebody's violent, if they're dangerous, if they're mentally disabled in some way, either from mental illness or horrible abuse or some other, or drugs and alcohol, for heaven's sake, some of this is going to be a lot less effective.
Right, right.
All right? But in general, yeah, I mean, when I treat couples, part of what I try to teach them is if the other person is really upset, who has the emergency? They need you to be supportive of them when they're upset, not retaliate.
Right, yeah, because it just escalates things.
It
escalates
for no gain.
Yeah, I mean, you think about when you have an argument with your spouse, you know,
yeah.
If you just keep yelling at one another.
You can't get anywhere.
Right.
Right?
Well, and forgive me, because for me it always comes back to this, because this is always the point of contention in my life. I keep thinking about how President Obama has tried to deal with the Republicans, and I really have seen him try to be nurturing to them, I think.
Yes.
You know, he has tried to, even though they don't see it or want to publicly deny it, it feels like to me he has constantly offers a hand, and it just keeps getting bitten, or he's lied about, or blah, blah, blah. I guess I'm, you know, because I'm trying to figure out how to cope with my angst with Republicans. How do you deal with people that just sort of take this as weakness? Or, you know, is it just like the guy in the hallway? You just have to keep the nurturing up, and eventually maybe the wall cracks, you know?
Well, we're talking, this is on an individual basis, because what we're talking about here, and your guy in the hallway, that was relational.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Roy kept reaching out with a loving heart over and over again, and was not didn't take personally the guy's response.
Mm-hmm.
And when there was enough of that, eventually the guy's, whatever it was, his suspiciousness or his previous wounds or his general, you know, whatever, wherever his curmudgeonly things came from, they kind of melted in the face of that kindness from Roy. Now, he might not be like that with anybody else, but he was with Roy because of that investment of love. So
right.
On a personal one-to-one basis, this is what's very effective. It only gets to be effective on a social level when it's pervasive enough.
So what would that look like?
Well, what that would look like is if women could be trained, you know, could grow up to feel their own power is in their love and compassion and understanding, and they didn't take things personally or feel like they had to defend themselves or protect themselves or be ashamed of themselves all of the time. So that, in general, women didn't tolerate abuse, but they were compassionate and understanding and didn't escalate, but in fact always tried to create an atmosphere for repair and taking responsibility, the world would feel like a different place. But there would have to be enough women that it was part of, that it became the social structure. And I think that in many ways that's what we're focused on and working towards. We're just not there yet.
You know what you made me think of, and you didn't say it, but you know where my mind went? My mind went to the temple prostitutes. You know, thinking that perhaps they were the ones that handed out love and nurturing in the ancient world. And I'm thinking, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When a man's heart and soul were sore and in need of that kind of tender ministration, there were women who were trained to and who voluntarily provided it.
Yeah.
And they were honored and valued for it.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, if you're a man, say you're a conservative Christian, and you grow up in that culture of sex is taboo, then you can't enjoy that intimacy, maybe. And I almost wonder if that could be part of this, you know, the psychological makeup that, you know, makes, you know, some of these people not be able to appreciate love and nurturing or give it themselves.
Well, yes. If you grow up in an environment where needing tenderness and nurturing and kindness is seen as a weakness because it makes you less of a man, it's not in that act like a man box of behaviors, then you can't conscience-free allow yourself to have it. Now, if it's a guilty pleasure, like going to a prostitute, where she's a bad girl, so she doesn't deserve your honor and respect, and you have the right to demand from her whatever you want because you're better than she is, then you can let some of that in.
Yeah.
But it's not that this other thing that we're talking about with the temple prostitutes, of someone who is honored and valued for the gift that she has to bestow.
Right, right. And for that uplift she can give the her partner during that, during that intimacy.
Absolutely.
Duffy, this has been interesting stuff. I have really enjoyed talking to you tonight. We're going to have to chat again.
Absolutely. I have enjoyed it myself. We've been all over the map and still, I think, managed to make our points.
I think so. I think we have. I think we've gone in a lot of different directions here and connected a lot of dots. At least for me, we sure have. Well, please tell listeners if they're interested in your workshops or any of your public stuff or your counseling, how they can reach you.
All right. My name is Delphine DeMore, PhD, and I'm in Tarzana. My number is 818-757-3800. And I have a new Awakening Women's Spirit group starting in February. So if anyone is interested in knowing about that, they're welcome to call me about that as well.
Okay. Well, Duffy, it's been fun. Thank you so very much. And
well, thank
I
you
see,
for having me.
It's been my pleasure. And I see David is hanging on the line here, so I'm going to ask him to wait just another minute or two, and I'll be with him. But to you and Laura, have a wonderful, wonderful New Year's.
Happy New Year to you and to Roy and to all of your listeners as well, honey. I'll see.
All
look
right.
Forward to seeing you in the near future.
Okay. Good
all
night.
Right.
Thank
good
you.
Night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. That was lots of fun, and I sure learned a lot from Duffy. I most certainly did. And that tells me that we are crossing the threshold and seeing the second part of the show. And before we get to David here, I want to remind you about the two F's. Please click the follow button on my show page so you get news of who's on the show each week without having to rely on getting a reminder email from me. And please, I invite you to also click the friend button and become a friend of the show. That will instantly make you a part of the International Voices of the Sacred Feminine Family. I also want to bring to your attention some of the past shows that we've had. I know with the holidays things are really busy, but I want to make sure you don't miss in the archives. I spoke to Genevieve Vaughn about the gift economy, how that is really a maternal economy. I couldn't help but think about that in the back of my mind as Duffy and I were talking about the values of the feminine. If you listen to that interview, you'll see what I'm talking about. Stacey Bourne, a pastor up at her church in San Francisco, we talked about their goddess mural project. Selena Fox, celebrating the winter solstice and the pagan roots of the holidays, is always fun. She's there in the archives. Last week, Jeanette Clancy, a theologian, we talked about the harmful sexist God talk and how that leads to female genital mutilation, human trafficking, domestic violence, all that horrible stuff, infanticide, which we briefly touched on tonight. Catherine Ravenwood, How to Create Sacred Water, Meredith Smith, Dream Workers Behind the Veil, how people actually do work in their dreams, night shift dreams. Hannah Rosen, The End of Men or Male Dominance and Women's Rise to Economic Freedom. Ray Abelay of Code Pink in her book about activism. Lots of good stuff there in the archive. I hope you will we'll take a look. Also, I want to make sure you know about a documentary that is coming out really soon. It's called FEMME, F-E-M-M-E, Women Healing the World, at a special screening last week at Olandor in Malibu. Emmanuel Etier, he's a French fella, really nice guy. He's the producer of Wonderland Entertainment. He announced that the film, Femme, is scheduled to be released in early 2013. And men and women from around the L.A. area were invited to view the film, which is executive produced by Sharon Stone. And it highlighted visionaries and scholars that I know you will recognize, listeners, Jean Shinoda Bolen, Jean Houston, Marianne Williamson, Rhian Eisler, Barbara Marx Hubbard. You probably recognize a lot of those names. They've been right here on the show. Miriam Robin Dexter, and I have to admit, pat myself on the back just a little bit, I'm actually in the film as well. I sort of carry part of the goddess spirituality story in the documentary. And anyway, for 3 years, the producer had been traveling around the world interviewing women across the globe to get their feedback on the state of the world and what we can do about saving the planet and life as we know it. And, well, you know, they talk about the consensus is it's time for women and men to work together in partnership using both their feminine and masculine attributes to shift the world away from patriarchy. You know, it's time for women to step up and claim their mantle of leadership. And that was an important point. You know, it's not going to be handed to us. Women need to claim it and guide the way toward a world of caring economics that benefits everyone on the planet, not just certain men or a select group of elites. And I think the film is a daring undertaking that starts at the beginning, tells about goddess cultures and the loss of the sacred feminine, and it moves forward to show what diminishing women and the rise of capitalism and patriarchy have done to the female gender on the planet. You can find out more about the film if you go to Wonderland Entertainment Group. There's a clip there, or you can go to email me and I'll send you a clip, KarenTate108@ca.rr.com. I know there's a YouTube, lots of YouTube clips. You might be able to just put in Femme, F-E-M-M-E. It might come up, I'm not sure, but most definitely Wonderland Entertainment Group has a website and there are trailers there. So, I am going to unmute David. Hey, David.
Hello, Karen. How are you?
I'm good, and I'm so glad to have you back on the show.
It's great to be back.
Well, you know, just in case I have some new listeners, because believe it, I have been the show listenership has just been growing by leaps and bounds this year. I'm amazed when I see the stats. Some of them may not know you yet, David. So I'm going to read your bio before we get into our chat. Dr. David C. A. Hillman earned a Ph.D. in classics and M.S. in bacteriology. I never can say that word. From the University of Wisconsin, where he studied the medicine and pharmacology of antiquity. The London Times described his research as the last wild frontier of classical studies. Dr. Hillman's work, while firmly grounded in primary sources, the original documents of church authorities and others, is highly controversial. That's why we love him so much. It is research that modern church officials don't want known. His dissertation committee actually refused to pass him unless he removed material about the use of psychedelic drugs in antiquity. And so he later, you know, he didn't waste that material. He published the forbidden material in his first book called The Chemical Muse. And I highly recommend listeners, you go back in the archives and listen to some of the wonderful interviews we did about his book, The Chemical Muse, and the use of hallucinogens in ancient times and ritual. And his last book, Original Sin, revelations there even more shocking, talked about pedophile Catholic priests and higher church authorities who have protected them and allowed child abuse to continue for years, but it goes back to the earliest days of the church. But tonight we're sort of, you know, going in a little bit different direction because we've talked about both of his books, and but David is such an expert on Greek religion and ancient times because he translates his own Greek and doesn't have to rely on Christian translations, we thought it would be fun tonight to talk about how contemporary people just misunderstand the gods and how our relationship with the gods today is so different than people in the ancient times. So, that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. So, David, where do you think we should start? I know it's a big subject.
Oh, let's get off on the right foot and start with BDSM, shall we? Let's talk about bondage and sadomasochism and that kind of stuff.
You mean that has something to do with the ancient Greek gods?
It sure does. You know, I was thinking about getting ready for talking with you, I'm really humbled because although I consider myself an expert in ancient Greek and Latin and these medical sources that I work with, it's very humbling to be asked about general questions about the gods. I kind of tried to take it very seriously, and as I was thinking to myself, what image could I give your audience of maybe the person who is closest to kind of authentic ancient religion that I've come across? I have to honestly say, and there have been a number, but the one that really strikes me that I think is a great, it'll stick out to your audience, is a woman whose name I will not mention. I'll protect her, but she is in the BDSM community. She is a dominatrix in the BDSM community, and she is involved in acts that are very, very, very similar, that are the most similar cult acts to the ancient worship of Priapus and the ancient worship of Pan and the ancient worship of Aphrodite and the ancient worship of Dionysus. She's the closest. When she speaks, you can tell, you can hear, you can distill from her voice the message that the ancient poets had. So Sappho, when she speaks, it's like listening to Sappho. And you and I have talked before, Karen, about how that every once in a while you are in kind of in tune. You strike a tune in my ear, like, oh, she is closer to kind of an understanding of the cosmos, like the Greeks had it, than moderns are. And I get that every once in a while, but I get that most strongly with this dominatrix. And she is, I think I wanted to throw that out there as an example, just to get kind of shock your audience into saying, because...
Well, you know, we have these, I've seen the movies, I've seen the pictures, I think I know the website you're talking about. I don't think when people think about the gods, they automatically think about S&M. So you got to connect the dots here for us. How does S&M and bondage, how does that connect to how the ancients worshipped their gods or saw their gods?
You know, that's a great question, and I'll just I want to have this interview with us go more back and forth instead of me just blathering on.
Okay.
So I'll say something short, and you jump in with your intuition.
Okay. Don't worry.
And you let
I
me
will.
Know what
I'm
you
not
think.
Shy.
The well, yes, sometimes I just talk over, so I don't want to talk over you.
Okay.
And so let me know what you think, honestly. But how does that remind us of the ancient? You know what, when we study the ancient cult and ancient religion, when I say cult, I just mean religious practices. When you study ancient cult, you see odd things that strike modern audiences as odd. For example, you see pillars of Hermes or a different gods with very large phalluses. So you see erect penises.
Right.
And we don't. And that strikes us that why would you worship this thing? What did this have to do? We know that there are dildos that are associated with religious practice. We know that there are groups of female priestesses who are extremely well-schooled in the use of drugs that you just apply to the genitals. There are drugs that you apply to the penis, drugs that you apply to the vagina, to the labia, to the anus. There are all these crazy things out there that we really don't – they strike us – as modern monotheists, they strike us as odd. So,
Wait. Okay, so Priapus, just in case the listeners who haven't heard Priapus, when you go to the museums, he's the one that has the huge phallus, and lots of times it's surrounded by fruit and vegetables and things. And but you know, but to answer your question, well, when I would see him, David, I mean, I know the ancients didn't have the sexual hang-ups that, you know, a lot of us do because of the Abrahamic religions and Christianity, but I thought it just meant fertility, you know, the fertility of the land so that the people could eat, and infant mortality was really high, so, you know, so that people, you know, would live and be fruitful and multiply. But you're saying there's more to it than that.
Yes, exactly. I'm saying there's more to it because those cult statues and those cult objects are actually used in the process of worship. So it can have an idea of fertility behind it, but the priestess who is using one of those on her male subject who's tied up, and she's applied a drug to this leather or stone dildo and then is applying it to his rectum so that the drug can have its effect directly into his bloodstream, essentially is what they're doing. There's something more than she's not thinking about fertility.
No.
And he's not thinking. And he's not thinking about fertility.
Well, well, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of people who do this. What do you call it? That asphyxiation during sex. You know, they start to smother themselves or choke themselves. So I don't know. Maybe it heightens the pleasure or something. I mean, is that what we're talking about, or are we still talking about something different?
You know, I think those may be vehicles to get to the point. To get to the point that the priestess is actually trying to convey. Most ancient, and here's point number one I'll make. Most ancient cult, Roman, Greco-Roman cult, revolves around the idea of oracular vision. You read about all of these cults, and they always some idiot scholar always throws in, and I say that affectionately because I like classes, but some scholar always throws in, oh, this is an oracular cult. Well, if you stand back and look at how many of them are oracular, they all are. So this is what's funny is you have this figure. We'll stick with Priapus. Yes, he's got this large 3-foot, you know, erection that won't go away, and it's obvious, and it's way out there. And his priestesses, we know this because this is in, we have it in authors like Petronius who talks about it. What do the priestesses do? Well, it involves tying up, drugging and tying up your worshiper, and then applying a drug to him in different ways and involving different sexual acts. Now, you would think, oh, okay, this is just a reason for the pagans to sit around and do things, you know, just to pleasure themselves. But what's really fascinating is if you look at who Priapus actually is, in their, according to Pausanias, the ancient Greek traveler who's describing different temples, he actually tells us there's a temple to the Muses near Helicon in Greece. And in this temple, he says, is a very prominent, very beautiful statue of Priapus. And to a modern audience, again, it sounds odd. Why would you have this god, the god of the erection, why would you have him in this temple dedicated to these teenage girls? The Muses are just teenage girls. They're the voice. They're that voice that kills the tyrant. That's the real female powerful oracular voice. The voice that doesn't care about anything. That's passionate. That can't be bought. Essentially, that's the voice of the muse. And in her temple, in their temple, there's 9 of them, or different times, different numbers, but there's several of them. And in their temple, these temples ultimately become the libraries of the world. These temples are guarded by this figure called Priapus. Why would you have that? Well, if you start reading the poetry of Priapus, and guess what, Karen? This stuff, nobody translates this stuff today. You know, the best translation, the best non-academic translation that's out there that you can buy on Amazon was actually written by Sir Richard Burton. So this is old.
Book, David. There's your next book. I mean, seriously. Well, so is this about worshiping the orgasm, or is this about union with the gods that maybe they consider orgasm to be, or is it still something else?
You know, I think those are stepping stones to get to the bigger picture, because the bigger picture is something, when you read the priapic poetry, you realize he's the guardian of the garden. He's the one who guards the fruit. He's the one who's stationed there to make sure that in life, anybody who messes with the fruit of Mother Nature, who doesn't respect it, and who doesn't venerate it, that person, he says he has one punishment for, and it's sodomy. He's going to sodomize you if you don't respect the garden.
Monsanto better look out.
Exactly. Exactly. No, that's an excellent way to look at it. Exactly. See, that intuition kicks in? That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's not a Christian intuition. That's what I would call a pagan intuition. But he's the guardian of the garden. He's the one who watches. He's the one who actually protects the muses. It's a beautiful system that they built based upon nature that we oftentimes don't see because we're so.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot more intricate than I think back to reading Greek mythology, and I thought it was some of the most boring stuff that never made sense, and the stories were always different. My eyes sort of glazed over, but I think it's because we really, it seems like such a ball of confusion because I guess the stuff we were reading, it was never really translated properly or never really understood, or they didn't want to say what it really meant.
Well, exactly. You're seeing it through the Christian lens, and you're not just whistling Dixie, Karen, because there was actually a Roman emperor named Julian who became known as Julian the Apostate, and by the church. And Julian was issued an order that no Christian should be allowed to teach mythology, what we call mythology now. That no Christian should be able to teach it, because he said they're warping it. They're turning it into something it's not. When you go, and you can't help this, our culture is a Judeo-Christian culture. It is a monotheist Judeo-Christian culture. So the terms that we use, the ideas that we use, the lens that we look through, that we see this mythology through, is all Christian. So we can't really understand it as they understood it. I studied mythology for 12 years in college, and I didn't start understanding it until about year 8. So, and when I suddenly began to be able to read this stuff really for myself and be able to really digest it on my own without that lens, I was shocked. I was shocked at the differences. I was shocked at how beautiful it was and how it was not the mythology that I had been taught for years.
Well, it's almost as if you have to start your own cult, David, and start, what do you call it when you try to break the brainwashing? We need to have interventions and sort of get people out of our poisoned mindsets, from the Judeo-Christian haze that we all look at everything through.
Yeah, it's sad because it's sad because the ancient world declared that there's this god called Pan that you well know, and your listeners well know of Pan, and he's the one god that the ancient world declared to be dead. He died. There was a person who was sailing on a ship one day, and they were passing a place where he was notoriously worshipped, and he heard a voice that said, "Tell the world that Pan is dead." And it's sad because you could start a cult now, and you could start a movement, and you could start a kind of a pagan revival, and it would be like, I've thought about this many times, it's kind of like trying to resuscitate a corpse. It's sad. It's sad to see people wanting this thing to be alive, but it is dead. It is truly dead. And the reason the pagans themselves said Pan had died was he was defeated. He was literally defeated by Pan is the figure that ultimately became Lucifer.
Right.
And this is what's so disgusting is the Christians picked on Pan because of his prominence in ancient worship in the first, second, third, fourth, centuries AD in the, at that time. He was so prominent because Pan is the figure. This is really cool. He is the one who guarded the nurse of the Olympians. So the goddess that gave her milk, the milk from her own body, to the Olympians, he was the one who protected her. He's the protector of the nurse. You know, your previous guest talked about, you guys were talking about nursing a little bit, nutriment. You were talking about this nurturing figure, the female. Well, Pan was the one who guarded her. And the Christians knew that getting rid of Pan, making Pan the evil one, would ultimately take down the worship of this guardian. It would take down the worship of this nurturing woman. And that's what's so sad about it. That's what he does. He's known as he's the protector of nymphs, these tree spirits that kind of embody everything that nature is about and this beautiful voice that nature has.
Well,
and that's
it's reminded me of when the movie Avatar came out. I mean, I love that movie. To me, it was Goddess Church. Mm-hmm. And you know, because you saw like the interconnection and all of that sort of stuff, the reverence for nature and the, you know, the big bad corporations and, you know, the whole nine yards. But where was I going with this? Oh, yeah. So the Pope, almost to me, the fact that the Pope would have to come out and comment on a movie like Avatar said to me he was afraid of the influence of that movie. And he or one of his spokespeople for him came out and said, nature will never replace your religion. And I think, is that where these stepping stones that, you know, you're talking about, the hallucinogens, the sexuality, the bondage, is this all about nature, you know, and what we're so disconnected from now?
Yes.
That we can't even imagine it anymore?
Exactly. We have been engaged in the last 2,000 years. We've been engaged in a war that has killed more people than any single conflict throughout history, more than World War I and II together. This is a conflict that has persisted for the last 2,000 years, and it's essentially a conflict between nature and a message. It's almost viral. It's almost, if you think of a virus, what does a virus do? A virus really doesn't do anything except propagate its own message, propagate its own DNA or RNA. That's all it does, is it propagates a message that says, keep making copies of self, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the war that's been going on, exactly as you just said it. It's a war. The Pope said what he did because he's been saying, he said the same thing that they said to the first Pope said, and the first priest said, and the first elder said back 1900, 2000 years, almost 2000 years ago. It's the exact same thing. It's the message that nature is bad. Nature is bad. Here's the plan to step away from nature and to gain something that we're going to give you, namely salvation. Now, 1,800 years ago, you had, if you were a little boy, you had to bend over and get sodomized in order to get that package. Women, this is what's curious. Women were irredeemable, right? Do you know what the original sin was? According to the early church, the original sin was female allure. Isn't that funny? Female beauty.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, that's why we have the burqa today, right?
Well, exactly, right. But in their days, you didn't just cover a woman up. That wasn't enough. You had to sodomize the desire for women out of young boys in what they originally called their catechesis. You had to sodomize it out of them, which works. Karen, it works. I saw an interview done in a documentary in 2006, Keep Us From Evil, I think it was called, Lead Us From Evil, in which the victim of one of these pedophile priests said very openly, he said, I've always had problems now with women. I can never become intimate. There's always something about it that keeps me from doing it. Sodomizing a young boy will do that. Forcefully raping a child will cause them to have difficulties accepting a female, especially a dominant female presence in their life. So the early Christians were very, very aware of this and were doing it. And
so
it's an
intentional strategy.
Oh, yes. No, it's an integral part of the church. You can't separate pedophilia from the early Christian church.
So,
it's not
Dave,
a... It, go ahead.
Well, okay. So, but I think I'm still missing something. Maybe it's just when we say nature, it's so vague. You know, what is it that they wanted to take away from us? You know, I don't know if I'm asking the question properly. You know, what did they strip out of our culture?
You're asking it exactly right. What do they try to take? What do they want to take from us? You can go back and don't take my word for it. Go back to people like Tertullian. Go back to people like Origen, ancient old church fathers, and see what they say. And they tell you exactly what it was that they wanted to take away, and that is beauty. Beauty is a sin. Beauty is a sin. Whether it's the beauty that you encounter when you listen to music, or the beauty that you encounter when you see your beau into the room and you're suddenly overwhelmed with passion, or whether it's the beauty of the rising sun. Those are the things that the pagans said are signs of the God's power. And it was that beauty that the Christians explicitly, openly condemned.
So, okay, so this makes sense. That's everything that gives you pleasure.
Right.
I mean, it's beauty, it's sexuality, it's music, it's passion. I mean, all the things that make life worth living.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And that's why it's...
So, I mean, that would make all of them a bunch of sadists and masochists.
How else, Karen, can you obtain salvation? There's no other way to obtain salvation. Because in order to buy the insurance plan, you have to see that there's a need for it, right? You're not going to buy auto insurance if you don't drive, right?
So
you're not worried about an accident.
So you demonize all of the things that give life pleasure and meaning so that you can make salvation a more important goal than pleasure.
Correct. And that's exactly how the catechetical schools, there's a catechetical school in Alexandria. That's exactly how they instructed their exorcists to proceed in raping children. You have to show the child that by burning through the desire for sex, that you're able to achieve Jesus and salvation. Yeah.
So you're left with a bunch of empty worker drones. I mean, that's what it feels like. You know, you're left with very little humanity. I don't know. That's what it feels like. You know, I'm getting this picture, I don't know, some movie I saw where all of these men, it's everything is black and gray, and all of these men are dressed in the same suits, and they're carrying their briefcases, and they're all walking off to work, and they look like they're, you know, the most miserable people on the face of the earth, but they do it day in and day out and day in and day out. It's sort of like that's what they created. That's what they wanted for humanity.
Right. No, you're exactly right. They had a word for that. And the word in Greek was typhius. That's what they called it. They called monotheism typhius because the Christians and the Jews were not the first monotheists, right? Monotheism is a recurrent theme and in history. And the polytheists at the time, the pagans, said they had a way of describing monotheism, and that is what they called typhius. It's a multi-headed monster whose sole job is to wipe out the gods, to wipe out... And remember, the first atheists in Western culture were Christians. The pagans are the ones that coined the term atheist. They coined it because the Christians didn't follow the gods, so they said they were without the gods, or atheist. And this atheist beast, who has no respect for nature, is a destroyer, a colonizer. It's essentially a huge virus. Is the way they looked at it. It's a multi-headed virus that destroys its surroundings, has no, and this is what's kind of funny, not funny in a good way, but in a strange way, is typhius, this monster of monotheism, is always portrayed as being injurious to nature. If nature gets in his way, he's going to destroy it.
Wow. You always bring these added elements, you know, to this whole thing. And I mean, you know, I have my issues with Christianity and, you know, in Judeo-Christianity because of what they've done women. But then when you, you know, you add these other elements to it, I mean, it's unconscionable, you know. And I think about the people who don't even have a clue what they're out there trying to perpetuate in the world or defend or spread. And, you know, if they could all just wake up one morning and that ignorance be gone.
Well, and you know what? This is what's puzzling to me, Karen. If they could all wake up and just let the ignorance be gone. Here's what's puzzling to me is, according to the way that the Greeks and the Romans who were religious thought, is they thought that the these people who were controlled by Typhius, these servants of Typhius, they're actually made that way for a purpose. It's very strange. It's very strange. Typhius is ultimately destroyed by Olympus, right? He's ultimately destroyed. And guess who destroys him? The only god who stands with the king of Olympus is Athena. She's actually the tool. She's actually the tool. It's the voice. It's her voice. It's the voice of a woman who ultimately is able to destroy Typhius. Right? She ultimately gives the lightning to Zeus. She gives him the power and the ability. There is something, Karen, if your audience would just read some of the documents, and I'm sure a lot of them do actually, but if they would just read some of the documents that come out of the 3rd and 4th centuries, documents that are both pagan and Christian, they would see this incredible massacre that was beginning to take place. And it's a massacre of freedom. It's a massacre of free speech. It's a massacre of being able to, for a woman, especially women, to speak. And everybody assumes that, well, all women before the 20th century were chattel. And that is the most I've had more difficulty in trying to convince people of the opposite. It's just the opposite. That these early Greek priestesses and these Roman priests, the followers of Bona Dea and the followers, these gods that we don't even know, right? Followers of Bona Dea and followers of these priestesses of Aphrodite particularly, who had so much, who wielded so much political power, and who were able to stand up and say, put this tyrant to death, and he was put to death immediately, without question. Because they were sacrosanct. They were completely sacrosanct. And we so undercut, I know you and I have talked about that, but we so undercut their prominent role that it just, there in the 3rd and 4th centuries, there's a focus upon, society begins to focus, as Christianity comes to political power, society begins to focus on undercutting women, particularly.
In a way, you've just sort of given a clue maybe as to why, or at least part of why. I mean, if it's Athena, if it's the female voice, if she is the one giving Zeus the power to defeat monotheism, how do you pronounce it again? How did you say it?
Typhius. You can say
Typhius.
Typhon if you want, or you can say Typhius in the Greek.
Typhius, Typhon. Then the Christians knew that it was woman who held the power, and it was woman and her association with nature that they had to oppress, that they had to diminish.
Right,
I mean,
and you know
that,
this.
Is it that simple?
Yes, you can prove this historically too, because the very first, as Christian bishops came to political power, especially in the 4th century, as they started getting political power, real political power, the first group that they targeted were the female oracles, the sibyls. They're the first group that they targeted. They don't go after, it's funny, they don't go after prominent Roman officials, they don't go after generals, they don't do what you'd expect any kind of coup to do. They actually start going after priestesses, because they know they're brilliant. These bishops were brilliant, and they knew the way to change society was to change the most dominant, powerful voices at the time. Forget the positions. Forget who was governor. Forget it. They all did what the bureaucracy told them to do. It was the women who were guiding the political landscape. Those are the ones. If you can get them, if you can shut them up, you can change the world. And that's exactly what they did. And the oracle said this. They said, if we fall, so will the Western way. And sure enough, it's exactly what happened. And that's the time that Pan said, you know, we got the voice of Pan. Pan is dead. He's not here anymore.
Okay, well, before we run out of time, because we're down to 20 minutes now, believe it or not, let's get into some of these other things. Like you said that you can't honor the divine within and also honor the gods. I know that's a big deal that they talk about today in paganism, you know, finding the divine within. Explain why that can't be, you know, why that wouldn't, I guess the ancients didn't think that way.
Yeah, no, and this is for your audience. These are my thoughts, not Karen's thoughts. So don't send her any nasty email. Send it to me. Send it to me at dcahillmanchemicalmuse.com. Anyway, anybody who starts talking about the god or goddess within is not talking about ancient religion. They're taking Christianity and they're morphing it into kind of a pagan mold. And this is a very common thing to do with modern pagans. I laugh. I don't laugh in their face, but I laugh when I read about what the pagans are doing because it's so ineffective and it's so watered down and it's so completely Christian that it's amazing. It's amazing. It just makes me think, wow, if you actually knew what they were doing, you wouldn't be doing that. But no, you can't. It's the whole life is not about you. Remember, God is love according to Christianity, but not according to ancient religion. Not according to the Greco-Roman pantheon. God is not love. There is no God of love, right? There's a God of desire, and that's a hugely different thing. But there is no God of love. And what's funny is the gods don't love you. You can actually be a servant of theirs and get your butt kicked in a huge way just for the most seemingly, you know, innocuous kind of thing. They get the forces that be, that govern the world, can get really pissed. And in ways that we would think, well, it means they don't love us. Let me just say this, and I'll shut up and let's get to more questions, or more topics. But people are always saying, why do bad things happen to good people? Which is not, that's a Christian thing, that's not pagan, right? Because good things don't happen to bad people. Let me give you an example that's going to really tick off your audience. We just had a shooting in which a freak went into a school and shot up 20 young children, right?
Right.
You can't think of a more freakish thing in the world. Our response was, it's the video games, it's the guns in the school, you know, it's X, Y, and Z. I don't see anybody. And then we saw President Obama stand up and console the mothers and fathers of those children. I have not seen him once fly to Afghanistan to console the mother of a child that one of our drones destroyed. I didn't see him go to Haditha, where our Marines executed young 12-year-old girls. It put guns to the back of their heads and blew their brains out. I don't see him consoling those people. You know what the Greeks would say? We deserved that. We deserved it because when you give nature something, she gives it right back to you, especially if it's dark. If you give nature something dark, she turns around and she gives you dark back. I think
so. You're talking about the threefold law. What you put out comes back to you threefold.
I think that's a pretty good way to express it. Except it's more like I think it's more simple than that, Karen. If you have blood on your hands, the gods bring vengeance. You know, there are gods whose sole job, and let's face it, we as Americans have a lot of blood on our hands.
Right. Why would it be innocent children and not, you know, politicians or, you know, corporate raiders, you know, the people who are responsible for the death and destruction?
Right, because that's an excellent question, and I'll tell you what I think an ancient priestess would tell you. Because the blood that is required at your hands, America, is the blood of your innocent.
Ah.
Right?
Because they want the suffering. They want you to feel the grief.
Right. The gods don't love your children. See, this is the problem Christianity really has. And let's face it, when we saw the Obama a memorial for the 20 children that were slain in Newton. It was a Christian memorial. It was a monotheist. You know, you had your Jewish rabbi there, but you had a lot of ministers and a lot of priests. You had a priest and whatnot, and they were doing their thing. And they're asking themselves. We heard this over and over and over with the counseling and the this and the that. How could God allow something? Because God is love, and ultimately those children are in heaven with their God, and they're all happy, and this is when he called them up. So what is going on? Why does God allow such things to happen? Well, maybe it's because of the homosexuals, right? Well, there's a good answer, right? No, the Greeks would tell you, hey, when you spill innocent blood, the gods don't love you. They act as nature always acts. If you jump off a bridge, gravity is going to kill you. That's the way it is. It's nature. And so if you kill children in a foreign country, which our tax dollars have been paying to do, guess what happens? Nature sends it right back to you, right? The soldiers, this is pagan, Karen. This is super, super pagan. The soldiers that come back from war have to be purified from the blood that they have shed. And if they shed blood that's innocent, they can't be purified. That's the rule in the ancient world. You don't go to an enemy and kill their children. You don't do that.
So
if you do, the gods.
So soldiers are irredeemable then, if that's what they have to do as a soldier.
According to the Greeks and the Romans, those soldiers are if they are defending their own homes on the battlefield against other soldiers, they can be purified. They can be purified of that crime, that moral crime. It's still a crime. But if they overstep the bounds and they kill children, they can never be purified. And what is the punishment? The furies come after you, and you start having dreams. I'm talking ancient world stuff. You start having dreams, and your victims will come back at you in your dreams. You know, I had a brother. I hate to get personal, but I had a brother who was in the first Gulf War. And he was a sniper with the Marines, and he's way up front, and they shot up a car full of children. They didn't mean to, but they did. And I'll tell you, that was years ago. That was over a decade ago. Easy. You know, the first Gulf War was a long time ago. And he still, to this day, wakes up at night in a cold sweat crying about those children. And I think if he's lucky enough to get to his grave without blowing his own brains out, He will have beaten the odds that I put against him.
It makes you think about all the homeless veterans who just can't reacclimate into society. Mm-hmm. It's like they're damaged.
Right, right. You can't put somebody in a situation where they are forced to kill innocent people and expect that they're going to come out of it normal. It's not natural. And that's what I'm saying is a Christian army can do that. A crusader can do that. Paint a cross on his shield, send him out, and let him cut off children's heads. And he's justified because he's a soldier of God. That's the monotheist view. The polytheist view is you can't do that because
right.
Nature will come back and get you. And I'm saying that's what really gets me is the pagans today are not standing up for what real paganism is.
Well,
I
don't think we probably know is the thing, you know, because I can see what you mean, you know, if compared to what you're saying the gods are, you don't hear anybody within paganism that I know of anyway that talk like that. It's more of a, you know, sort of a Christianized idea, you know. Yes, you know, or like the goddesses are archetypes, but, you know, I mean, some of them still believe that, that the goddesses care about them. You know, they'll pray to the goddesses and things like that. And but I think you're saying that don't do a damn bit of good. Maybe
no.
And we don't have. I know we're not going to have enough time to talk about this thoroughly. So when the ancients made offerings to the gods, when the ancients prayed to the gods, they obviously must have thought the gods were going to listen to their prayers. I mean, Isis, for one, I mean, they talk about how she was one of the most accessible goddesses because she heard people's prayers. People thought that she could identify with their suffering. Is it just the Greeks were different, or
no? I'm glad you.
Is this the Christian lens again?
I'm glad it is the Christian lens again. I'm glad you bring up ISIS. I'll give you one quick example about her. So we have this guy who's writing in the Roman imperial period, who's writing about this poor guy who goes through all of these sufferings. The author's name is Apuleius, and he's writing about his main character goes through all of these sufferings, and he gets to after wandering around, getting abused, getting beaten up, getting mistreated, maltreated. He finally just gets on, basically he drops to his knees in a point of exhaustion, and he asks the goddess to kill him because he can't take it. He can't take any more of the suffering. He cannot take it. And what does she do? She appears to him in a dream. He falls asleep out of exhaustion on the beach, and he sees the moon rising. And in the moon, he sees the face of Isis. And Isis basically tells him, "Now you understand who I am. Now you're done. Okay. Now I'm going to put my stamp on you." And it's an idea that we don't understand, because we think that God is there to give us things, namely salvation. He's our little insurance man. He's going to give us. We pray to him. He heals grandma's cancer. Right? That's what he's there for. I mean, what else does God do? He protects our children.
But, you know, David, I think, though, I mean, yes, that, but I also, I mean, that's what I grew up learning, and I still think of it. I mean, I'll still pray to Goddess. But I also think Goddess is here to teach us hard lessons, too, to make us the best that we can be, to challenge us. Is that a little bit closer to the, you know, to the Greek idea of God?
I think what you're saying is what I was trying to get to with Apuleius, and that is that the God is there. The God is there and doesn't, you know, you're a temporal deity. You're a temporal being. You're in and out. You go in and out of time. But they're there always. Even when the earth is gone, some other planet is going to have organisms that will ultimately desire one another, and they will be subject to Aphrodite or Isis. So their job there is to not get you what you want. But their job there is to receive from you what the Greeks called eusebia, which the Romans called pietas. And that is acknowledgement. And if that takes, and that isn't something that is just granted, that you just give me, you know, like heal grandma's cancer, right? It's not in the same area. It's an ability to understand. If you're asking the goddess for things, yes. Yes, you're asking her for an ability to recognize her. That kind of thing they will listen to, because you can't respect. She's also a nurturing goddess. You cannot send drones to kill children in respect of ISIS. You can't do that. You cannot do that.
Yeah, but I mean, as individuals, we don't control the government.
So what's your question? I don't understand what your question
well,
is.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is... Okay, how do I phrase it? excuse me. Okay, all right. You're saying you can't ask ISIS for things because it sounded like because we're killing kids and other lands. But I'm saying that the average person in their average everyday life, you know, they don't have any control over horrible things like that. You know, the most they might do is, I don't know, key their neighbor's car, or I'm not talking about the crazies who take guns and kill people, or the ones who, you know, write laws so that kids starve to death. You know, your average person doesn't have any control over society. The most they can do is just try to live their life as a decent person. And if they do that, then do they have a right to, you know, ask the gods to protect them or help them?
Again, that's what I mean. The perspective is one of Christianity versus paganism. So the stain spreads. They look at the human family as a family. And in their way of viewing things, according to the Greco-Roman tradition, there are watchers in the world. There are watchers who just, their only job is to walk around and observe the family. And what they do is they report. They used to report to Justice, the goddess Justice, but she packed up and left the earth generations ago because she was sick of the fact that money had so corrupted humanity. Isn't this beautiful? Isn't it beautiful?
Yeah.
Mythology.
Right.
You know, beautiful.
And so she left back in ancient times. So imagine if she were here now.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So they view this generation, and that's what's funny is you read the Iliad or the Odyssey, or you read any of the lyric poetry, and the gods have so much disdain for the human family. Yeah, you and I may not. You and I may not fly a drone. I don't fly drones, you know. But every time I see on my television that a child is murdered by a drone that my government sent after them that I am not doing anything about, that stain is imputed to me. See, they have this idea that human beings carry a capacity for guilt and a capacity for innocence. And when you waive your capacity for innocence by not standing against the guilt, then you absorb the guilt. You absorb the guilt. So it's an amazing, it's a very environmental kind of look. You don't just dump toxin into one lake and, well, that one lake is toxic now, but everything else is fine. This stuff spreads, you know, and that's the
so
kind of the way they.
Well, this is like you're your brother's keeper.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, seriously, yeah. I mean, it's almost as if, you know, we don't only have to worry about ourselves, but we have a responsibility to thwart evildoers everywhere. It's like we all have to be Batman.
Right, right. If somebody is willing, and this is a funny a phrase that the Greeks have, it's an aphorism that the Greeks have. The gods honor the person who's willing to stand against the tide. They honored that person because, like Sappho, Sappho stood against the tide. She stood against the predominant, prevailing tyranny of her time, and she labored to educate young girls into the mysteries of astronomy and geometry and poetry so that they could produce these beautiful works of poetry to fight against all the tyrants who were trying to control the world's money supply. It was amazing.
I have to ask you, okay, yeah. Just a little bit. Do you think maybe the gods might smile upon we feminists who are trying to uplift women and bring the sacred feminine values back into the world?
You know, Karen, if you're, you know, I'm going to have to say, if you're bringing back the sacred feminine, that's an honorable thing. That's an act of eusebia. It's an act of piety to try to resurrect that corpse, to try to resurrect. You know, every 3 years the Greeks had a ceremony where they would call back Iakos, and they would do this. He's Zagreus Dionysus. He's the god that was murdered by the Titans, these giants, these Typhius folk. And he's murdered, and every 3 years they would raise him from the dead. Literally, you know, they would have ceremonies where they would raise him. And the priestesses that did it were the priestesses of Persephone. Persephone. She's the one. She had the voice. She's always portrayed as this young girl who's the most liable to injury. She's the most innocent. She's the most in need of protection. It's her from mortals. It's her voice that's able to raise the spirit of nature again. It's the most beautiful stuff. And the funny thing is the gods, because they don't care whether mortals succeed. They don't care if mortals succeed. They really don't. And this is what's funny. They don't love you. If you're a pagan walking around praying to gods thinking they love you, you're not. Okay. You got to go back and you got to read these texts because they don't do that. But if you're a pagan who's prostrating yourself before the gods, trying to recall that sacred feminine voice, trying to recall Isis, right? Trying to recall Osiris, that is an act of piety.
Hmm. David, we have 2 minutes left, and I feel like we still have so much more. Maybe I can twist your arm and have you come back in a month or so when I have another opening, and we can finish this. I haven't even got a chance to ask you about worshiping demons or any of this other stuff.
Yeah, you know, Karen, I'll come back anytime you'd like. You have so many important guests, though. I mean, don't put me in front of any of the big guests that you have, because that's,
oh, look,
you know, that's, you have so many good strong guest. That's just, if I could say, can I say one last thing to your audience? Just one kind of jump off point in the last minute.
Sure.
I would really like your audience to know that the forces of nature have never actually gone away. They are still there. There is still a goddess. There is still a god that is the voice of the creative woman. The voice of the, she's not you. You know, you're not a god, you're immortal. But there is still a force out there, that nurturing force, and there are still these forces that exist regardless of what the monotheists will tell you, regardless of how much they will pound it out of your heads. There are, it makes its way, and if you see a woman nursing, you ever see the love that a woman has for that infant? That's
mm-hmm.
there. That's there. If you ever see lovers, you ever see two lovers meet and they just it's almost disgusting how much they love each other.
Right.
It's almost disgusting how much they're drawn. That's that cosmic force. That will never. Christianity ultimately will fail for one reason, and this is what the Greeks, early Greeks, said about monotheism. Not me. These monotheisms will always fail because they are all subject to Aphrodite. They're all subject to Isis. They will fall because they're all subject to desire. They're all subject to desire. Every one of them.
All hail Aphrodite then. Well,
yes.
David, we have like 5 seconds left, so I'm going to have to say goodnight and with a promise to listeners that I will have you back on again.
Thank you so much, Karen, for having me.
Okay, goodnight.
Goodnight.